Hey guys, Norm here. I hope that this podcast finds you well in whatever you do. I just wanted to give you guys a little bit of a quick heads up on today's episode. Today's episode was kind of spawned from an impromptu conversation that came up, and the entire thing was recorded inside of a car. Now, the audio quality is not the usual audio quality of the podcast, and there is definitely a lot of background noise from the road. If it starts to bother you, I'd say set this episode aside and maybe listen to another one or just wait for the next episode. I did do what I could to normalize and reduce some of the background noise, but you know, if none of that bothers you, then all the better. I hope that you enjoy this podcast and learning a thing or two about what it's like to climb Mount Fuji. Without any further intro or ado, let's just jump right into today's episode. Welcome to the Tokyo Lens Podcast, and as always, if you're a regular listener, welcome back. Today we have a little bit of a special episode for those of you who are viewers of the Tokyo Lens YouTube channel. You're going to get a sneak peek at some of the content coming up, or at least hints towards what it might be. This episode is coming to you live from inside of a car, and I am joined by the one and only Victor from Fame of Travel. How you doing, Victor?
Pretty good. How are you?
I am doing good. Now that the intro is recorded, I am going to put this car in drive, and we are going to turn on to this expressway right here and hope that we are going in the right direction. Okay, so I would like to say, first off and foremost, I apologize about the sounds of the car and announcements of the navigation system and everything in the background. But today, so Victor and I were sitting here in the car, and we got to talking about Mount Fuji and how this year is going to be Victor's 8th climb in total. But Victor's kind of known for doing something a little bit special. Victor, what is that?
I am known for doing the sea to summit route.
Yes. So for people who don't know what the sea to summit route is, can you tell us a bit about that as we speed up here on the highway?
Will do. So the sea to summit route is literally just how it sounds. I start at the ocean, basically Suruga Bay in Fuji City, and basically hike, walk all the way up to the peak of Mount Fuji.
Okay. And that we'll get into like talking about how long that takes and everything later on. Mm-hmm. But I think most people don't typically climb Mount Fuji in that way, do they?
No, not at all.
Okay, so for those of you who like have never climbed Mount Fuji, the typical thing is to go up to the 5th station. Is that correct, Victor?
Correct, yes.
So there's a couple of different ways to get up there, and we're going to cover it. About a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, maybe less, Victor and I did a video on the Tokyo Lens channel where we gave, I think, a couple tips for climbing Mount Fuji.
That is correct.
And what we want to do today is just kind of walk through the planning and the process and what to expect when climbing Mount Fuji. So all of that explained, I kind of like to start with when you can and when you can't climb Mount Fuji, because I think a lot of people kind of get that wrong.
Yes, that's very true. There's been countless times where people have approached me trying to climb in like November, December, January.
When they will die.
Oh, yeah.
And outside of the fact that it's incredibly dangerous,
yes,
they also need a license to climb at that time, don't they? They got to get special permission from the government?
Yes, and register with the local police as well.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. Have you ever climbed outside of season?
Nope. And I do not plan to anytime soon.
Why is that?
I don't think I'm experienced enough, to be honest.
Okay. So what's the big difference between climbing in season and out of season?
Okay, so in season is basically the summertime, right?
Yeah.
So you're imagining in season at the peak, you know, you're waiting for the sun to pop up. It's still like 2 degrees, 4 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
Now imagine you know, late fall or November when there's already snow up there.
Uh-huh.
Now you're looking at negative temperatures.
Okay.
And on top of that, with the wind that's up there on the mountain, you get into like double digits negative. Celsius, by the way. So, yeah, that could get pretty risky.
Yeah, it doesn't sound... The climate itself, in my personal opinion, already isn't one of the most, like, pleasurable things you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So adding double-digit negative temperatures doesn't sound, like, fun for anybody.
No, not at all.
Do a lot of people do that outside of season?
Actually, quite a fair amount of people do, but the majority of them are either very experienced or they actually start at one of the fifth stations, which makes it a little bit easier.
And I think that's another common misconception people have when it comes to Mount Fuji itself, is that it's an easy climb, like you're just walking up a mountain, right? Mm-hmm. But it can actually be like a climb at some point.
Yes.
So now I kind of want to walk through the basics.
Okay.
I'm going to start by sharing a little bit of my experience. And I know in the YouTube video we got into some of my failures. We'll see if we hit on that today. But I'm going to walk through the basics of what I know is climbing Mount Fuji, and then have you talk about the difference for, like, when you're climbing sea to summit.
Okay.
So, starting with the basic climb. So the basic climb, and the climbing months are from when to when?
The climbing months are from, I believe it is July to September.
Okay. And if you look online, the information is readily available there, so you don't have to worry too much about that. But within the normal climbing months, I usually pick a day or two. I like to leave three in total. Like, you know, one day to go up, one day to come down, and one day to recover.
Mm-hmm.
And then inside of that, you get out to, you know, the area you need to get to, and then there's a bus. Which, do you remember from your non-sea to summit climbs off the top of your head what station you've got to get to in order to get to the fifth station?
The one time that I went non-sea to summit, we left from Shinjuku Station. Not at the station itself, but there's like a bus pickup zone.
Okay.
And that will take you over to the fifth station on the Fuji Yoshida side.
Gotcha. So there's actually a bus right from Shinjuku Station.
Correct.
See, I took a different route. I made the mistake of taking one of the more challenging routes from the beginning, and I had to take a train out to near Mount Fuji and then take a city bus from there.
Ah, okay.
And I think that's the first thing that throws people off that they don't expect, because the bus that goes up the mountain to the fifth station is an adventure all in its own. The way it's going around those hairpin turns over and over and over, you end up pretty dizzy by the time the bus stops.
Mm-hmm.
So you get up to the fifth station, you're fairly high up along the mountain already.
Yeah.
Now keep in mind there are several different routes.
Yes.
And depending on which route you take, there's different levels of difficulty, and there's different amounts of time you're going to spend as well.
Correct.
They say to start with one of the easier routes if you're not an experienced climber.
Mm-hmm.
Me being the high pride Canadian wilderness dude that I thought I was like, oh, I'll take one of these super long, difficult routes from the beginning. don't do that. If you're not, don't do that. But from there, all you really need to worry about, I guess, is two things. Number one, your gear. I guess three, okay. Your gear, your timing, what time you start your climb.
Correct.
And whether or not you're going to stay on the mountain. Right?
Yeah.
I'm assuming you typically stay at a hut on the mountain?
That is correct. It is pretty much almost mandatory, really.
Okay. Can you elaborate?
Well, if you have the stamina and if you are in shape, and most importantly, if you have the drive, technically you can do it in 24 hours, depending on your timing. However, for those that still want to challenge it, but, you know, do not have the full training on it, yeah, it's fine. Just stay on the mountain.
Okay.
You know?
It also enables you to, like, adjust to the altitude and kind of fight the altitude sickness, recover from the climb, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't stay at a hut.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
I, Nice save there, by the way. I decided that we were going to start climbing, I think, around 7 or 8 p.m., maybe later, maybe 9. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make sunrise, so I knew it was going to be about an 8 to 9 hour climb, mm-hmm. and I figured we'd just climb through the night, and then I made the mistake of booking a Shinkansen for the next day at 12
from Odawara.
Yeah. So I was like, we'll just get up there. We'll see the sunrise. There's not a whole lot else to do. Mm-hmm. And then we'll head back down.
Yeah.
I climbed with two buddies. I think my choice of playing it that way kind of put all of us through more of a difficult situation than we needed. So how do the huts work? Like, what is the cost? How many hours can you stay there? Do you have like a room, a bed? Are you sleeping on a floor? How does all that work?
That is a very good question. And it honestly depends on the route and the time of the hiking period that you're going to.
Okay.
So if you're going on the Fuji Yoshida side, that's known as basically like tourist alley.
Okay.
And because of that, the huts get filled up pretty quickly, mostly because of like tour groups and stuff like that, right?
Gotcha.
So it's almost mandatory to either go with a group or to make a reservation way ahead in advance.
Okay.
In regard to the actual rooms themselves, if you could imagine yourself in a coffin.
A coffin?
In a coffin.
Not a cabin.
Not a cabin. In a coffin. Now, if you could imagine yourself in a coffin, and now take the width of that coffin and slice it by half.
Oh, no.
That is as much space as you usually have if you stay in these huts.
Really?
And you're staying side to side with basically all these other people. Now, if you're worried about where you're going to put your stuff, they have these hooks on the walls where you generally just hang your backpack and hope that the hook stays and doesn't slam on your head while you're sleeping.
Okay. And so you're basically, you're Oliver twisting it, like, without the cot, right?
You're just stuck in there with everybody else. And when it comes to price, it depends on the options that you want to take.
Okay.
So generally, you're looking at a price of about like 8,000 yen per night.
Wow, really?
Yes.
I thought when you described it, I thought for sure it was going to be like 2,000, 3,000 yen for the night.
No, that's probably just for the food.
What?
The reason why I say options is because they usually come with an option for dinner.
Okay.
And dinner and breakfast.
Okay.
And depending on that, your price will go up to either 9,000 and possibly even to like 10,000 yen.
Wow. So about 9,000, 10,000 yen is roughly, with the, you know, the exchange rate always changing, about anywhere between $80 and $100.
Yeah.
American, Canadian, Australian, whatever it is. So, okay. And then, so these places do have food.
Yes, they do have food. Okay, and so some of them do have vegetarian options, but you have to let them know way in advance.
Oh, okay. So what kind of food are you talking generally for these?
To be very honest, the majority of the time it's some sort of curry with rice.
Okay.
And a vegetable soup.
Okay.
It's probably the most basic of basic things that you'll ever get.
All right. Okay.
But trust me, after climbing, it tastes amazing.
Understandable. So that's how the huts work.
Correct.
Okay.
And then you asked about
like
time,
a,
right?
Is there like a set number of hours you can be in there?
Yes. Depending on the hut, because I've had different varying experiences, is generally sleep time is 6 or 7 p.m.
Okay.
Anything after that, you have to do lights out. You have to be as quiet as possible.
Gotcha.
And everybody goes to bed. They turn off the lights.
Okay.
Some others will stay up a little bit later, around like 8 o'clock or so.
Uh-huh.
But that's probably the max.
Okay.
Now, in regards to waking up, here's the part that sucks. If you're staying in the lower part of the mountain, like 6th, 7th station, they will generally do lights on at 2 a.m. in the morning.
What?
And the reason for this is to make sure that everybody wakes up, everybody gets geared up, and starts making it up the mountain in order to get there in time. Because you're thinking about 2 a.m. in the morning, you're thinking, well, it's not that far. It's only like an hour climb up. But you're also forgetting the train of people that you're behind. It's this huge caravan that you have to wait behind. So there's that. However, if you give the owners a little bit heads up, you could pretty much stay until 8 a.m., I would venture.
Okay. And it doesn't impact the price at all?
It does not impact the price.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, I use that to my advantage when I do Sita Summit.
Okay. So do you stay longer?
Yep.
Okay.
So I generally try to plan my route where I arrive somewhere in the early evening on day one-ish, two-ish. And then in order to basically recover from, you know, walking 40 kilometers or so, I stay up until early morning, 8 a.m., have breakfast, take it easy, and then start my climb again.
Gotcha, gotcha. Okay. Do you, so I'm assuming then, do you end up staying at two different huts?
That is correct.
Wow, okay. All right, we'll get back to that. So that's kind of, you know, deciding whether you're going to stay, deciding what route you're going to take. The Yoshida route seems to be like the popular touristy style route, right? The really popular one. Is there a route you recommend that's typically less crowded?
I honestly recommend the Fujinomiya side, and that is the south side. So Yoshida is more kind of like the north side area, and that meets up with the Tsubarashi Trail.
Yes.
Subashiri Trail.
That's the one that I took, Subashiri.
Yeah. And then the Gotemba Trail is more kind of like on the east side.
Is that popular like the Yoshida? I feel like it is.
It is not. The Gotemba route is the best to go down on because it has the sand run. Okay. However, going up is probably the most mundane view in the world.
Because it's all rock and sand.
That, but the slope is kind of non-existent. So you're just winding back and forth forever.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
It's actually the longest of the routes.
And it just, it makes me remember so much that the one thing that stood out to me about the Mount Fuji climb was that you always think you're almost there. The top looks like it's always right in front of you.
Yep.
And you just never reach it. Like, you'll be like, oh, we're like, it looks like we're like an hour or two away from the top. Mm-hmm. And like 4.5 hours later, it still looks like you're an hour. Okay.
Yeah, so, that's torturous.
Recommended gear, and I think we'll both get into the obvious one of a very good ankle-supported pair of climbing footwear that you have already worn in.
That is absolutely true.
So, you were telling me a story earlier today as we were driving out to where we are right now about your experience with a brand new pair of footwear that you didn't wear in.
Yeah, that was definitely a nightmare. That was my first Sea to Summit.
Okay.
So I learned my lesson early. Basically, what I did to prepare for the trip itself, because I had no prior experience, there was little information on the net. I went out, bought the freshest pair of boots I could find, all this brand new gear, and I was like, cool, I'm ready to go. And I made the mistake wearing completely brand new boots from the ocean through the city, and I didn't make it that far past the city, and my feet were killing me.
And you said that like you were in like an actual open wound bleeding type situation.
Oh yeah, I had really horrible blisters.
That sounds just awful. Okay, so in that case, I guess in case I don't want to forget about it when we get into the deeper talk on Sea to Summit.
Okay,
but. Do you now change shoes partway through?
That is actually exactly what I do. So because you're actually going on the roads and the sidewalks themselves for probably like a good 3/4 of the trip itself, I actually bring tennis shoes, running shoes,
okay,
for the first part. And then it isn't until I get to the forest where I actually switch to my hiking boots.
You know, in all fairness, I slightly feel like I'm cheating on that because as I asked it, I was like, wait, did we not talk about that before? Like when we did the video? I think that was actually like one of your tips.
I think that was one of the points, yeah.
Yeah, is bring multiple shoes. So, sorry, it just hit me after I asked it. Okay, so outside of a good pair of shoes that you've worn in, because I had my own fail with the shoes, I got like what I thought was a good pair of hiking boots that ended up ripping on the way down in a terrible way that led to me breaking a toe. But outside of that, obviously enough water.
Correct.
I carried, I think, 2-liter bottle with me and at least 2 500-milliliter bottles. So a total of at least like 3 liters of water.
Yeah.
Is that... Like
that sounds about correct.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's about what I usually do.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that even if it is a, like, 36-degree summer day, that bringing warmer clothes for the top is going to be a good idea.
That is definitely true as well. A lot of people seem to skimp out on that, and they forget that it gets extremely cold and windy up there.
Yeah, like, they bring, like, a light jacket or a sweater. And, okay. So, what would you recommend as a proper piece of outerwear for when you get to, like, the higher up parts of the mountain?
I think if you could get, like, one of those fake down, kind of, like, poofy kind of, like, jackets.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty solid. Or if not, just get some underjohns.
I think you also mentioned the fact that, like, something that will break the wind.
Yes, that is definitely...
is also going to be, yeah.
But, I mean, you could kill two birds with one stone if you're able to get something that's, like, a waterproof top and bottom.
Okay.
Because that'll also pretty much knock down the wind as well. And make sure you get waterproof, not water-resistant. Because if it does rain, it's going to bleed through, and you're going to be very... very unhappy and wet.
And you know what? That whole if it does rain, that's a distinct possibility. Storms are a real thing that happen, right?
Oh, yeah, and they come quick.
And, like, you know Sharla.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a good friend of mine, Sharla, for those of you who, for some reason, don't know who Sharla is. Sharla is a YouTuber, and she did the climb a couple years back and had to abandon it partway through because the weather became so inclement that it just prevented them from climbing any further. Have you ever had to abandon one of your climbs?
I think the question should be, should have I abandoned one of my climbs?
Oh, no. Did you just keep going through it?
Yeah, oh. I did.
That sounds like a story to me.
Mm-hmm. There's been three situations where the weather was actually dangerous, and okay. I just kept pushing forward.
So, like, pick your favorite one and tell me, like, what made the weather dangerous? Was it the wind? Was it the rain? Did it start snowing? Like, what was the deal?
It was a severe lightning storm.
Why did you keep going?
Because there was nowhere else to go, and I was stuck in the middle of the forest.
Down sounds like a pretty good option. You're stuck in a wet forest during a lightning storm.
Well, that's,
like,
the thing. You're in the middle.
Up seems like a good idea. Like, what?
All I know is that I saw more trees hit by lightning down that I've already passed, as opposed to going back, going up, going forward.
I don't know, man. It just sounds like every part of that story is just riddled with bad ideas. But,
well, Sea to Summit isn't necessarily a smart idea either.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what gave birth to this episode, right? So, okay, so all that being said, outside of proper clothing, proper shoes, I'd like to toss one in there. Two things that feel like they come as, like a necessary set are a proper pair of gloves and a hiking pole.
Ah, yeah.
Like, I thought the pole was kind of a gimmick, but just in case, I made my own pole to go up.
Mm-hmm.
I actually just got rid of it when I moved house, and it was, like, such a sad moment to get rid of this pole. I made the entire thing out of, like, twine, what's it called? Like, wrapped around, like, two green garden poles,
mm-hmm.
And it was all done up like the handle of a samurai sword. It served me really, really well. Do you have, like, one climbing pole that you've always used, or do you get another one every year and you get a weird collection of them? Or?
I have a collection of two hiking poles of Fuji with every single stamp from Fuji Yoshida and Fujinomiya.
Wow, okay. Do you agree with the gloves thing?
Oh, absolutely agree with the gloves. And the reason for the gloves is, one, it does get cold, and if it does rain, it does protect you from that.
Yeah.
But they have, like, little chains and, like, rope in order, yeah, to kind of block off the climbing path. And when you get tired, you instinctively reach out to that without knowing that this rope could cut your hand open.
Yep.
And
yep,
that's just a rope, let alone the metal chains.
Well, it's a rope that's been exposed to,
yeah,
the,
exactly,
elements on a mountain for Lord knows how long, right?
So, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, gloves definitely recommended.
Excellent. So far, we are in unanimous agreement. I would say outside of that, do you have do you have recommended items that I've missed on the list for gear?
If you could get like a camelback or like a water retaining thing, okay. That is more useful than having like a full like 2 liter bottle, and that's just mostly for space purposes. It's like one of those water bags could, you know, you could compact it somewhere, it'll fit and give you some more room.
Yeah.
Aside from that, obviously you want a headlamp.
Yeah, a headlamp. How did I forget the headlamp? Actually, now that I think about it, did you bring headlamps for this journey? I know we talked about it.
No. I have an extra cell phone.
All right. Well, I brought lights. Okay. I brought lights. We'll figure it out. Without giving away the whole farm of what we're up to, moving on. So a hat.
Oh, Lord, definitely. Sunscreen for sure.
Yes. Sunglasses.
Yes.
Absolutely sunglasses. Okay. And the road seems to have gotten a little quieter. At least for now.
Okay.
I love how, as I say that, it's probably about to go to a patch of rough road, but... Alright, so, then in terms of, like, food, I pack, like, a trail mix of nuts and carbohydrates. Do you do it any differently, or do you do it similarly, or...?
I do it very similarly. I usually have... either almonds or cashews with me.
Okay, yep.
And then I actually go to the convenience store, and one of like the hidden gems that people for some reason are opposed to is getting those salad chickens.
Yep. I just picked up two of those when we stopped at the convenience store.
Well, like people are adverse to them because they think they're raw, but it's already cooked. It's cold.
Yeah.
It's still good.
This is a cold chicken breast, and they're actually really well flavored.
Yes.
I am very much partial to the smoked chicken breast that we just picked up at 7-Eleven. This is not sponsored by 7-Eleven, by the way. Yeah, those are really good. Okay. It's good to have some protein in there as well, yes. I guess. Excellent. So we've covered food, we've covered drink, we've covered headlamps and everything else. Is there anything else that you can think that would be of use?
Pacing. Knowing your pace.
Okay.
Which could mean the difference between you getting to the hut in time in order to stay, because they do close, or you being stuck outside waiting for the sun to rise.
All right. And, like, you would have already... Do you prepay for that online, or do you pay in cash when you get there?
I think you pay in cash when you get there.
Okay, so it's not like you've already had your money taken away.
Not that I know of, but then again, I'm very inexperienced when it comes to renting and staying in that.
It's still going to be, like, really cold, though.
Yeah.
Like... Yeah, especially the higher you get up. Okay, so that's the basics on the climb itself. So we've talked about sea to summit, and that's literally going from the sea to the summit. A basic climb you can do in anywhere from probably 7 to 11 hours, depending on the route you take.
Sounds about right.
How long does the sea to summit climb take you?
Again, it depends on your experience and your stamina and willpower.
Okay.
I've known some friends of mine that have been able to do it in 22, 24 hours.
Okay.
Me, personally, I like to take my time, and I get it completed within 3 days or so.
Okay. Wow, that's still pretty long.
Yeah.
So, when we talked about it previously, you said one of the biggest... like challenges that you see in the sea to summit is just the constant change of environment.
Yes.
Like you're literally going from like down by the ocean and like it might be hot and really humid and all that into the city, from the city up into a forest.
Correct.
And from the forest into this bland volcanic rock pile that you spend 5 to 7 hours in. Just staring at, wondering when it's going to end. Are there any other major challenges that make the sea to summit climb unique in your mind?
Honestly, aside from like the difference in the environment, it is the weather. The weather can turn on you in an instant. There have been times when I've climbed a sea to summit and the weather forecast just said sunny, 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 sunny. And this was when I had to go through a lightning storm in the middle of a forest.
I love how you say had to. Like, you legitimately did not have the option to not do it.
Not in my mind.
I don't know how to address that right now. So I'm just gonna smile and say okay. We all, I guess, handle it in our different ways.
Yeah.
But when one of the things that actually inspired me to pull out the voice recorder and like record this as a podcast episode is kind of the deeper side of it. Because for me, climbing Mount Fuji was going to be the one thing that, like, I did it once. I knew I wasn't going to do it twice. Okay? And it was my opportunity because Japan, in the time that I've been here, has changed as a country, both culturally and physically, so much. Mm-hmm. Like, that's one of the reasons that I love creating videos for YouTube, is because I can catch what Tokyo or Japan looks like right now. And it might look totally different in 10 years from now, and I can look back and be like, that's what it used to look like before all the flying cars were around, you know? But for me, Mount Fuji was the place to see the view of Japan that, other than the city lights, hasn't changed for like generations and generations, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, samurai and lords would have climbed up hundreds of years ago to see the same mountains and the same ocean view and all of that. And so for me, it was kind of like a pilgrimage. It was that go and see this thing, right, that is such a big part of Japan and Japan's history, because you can't go to like a public bath or something without seeing a painting of Mount Fuji. You can't go anywhere without seeing something of Mount Fuji. And so it was that one pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. But I also liked the way you addressed it, because you do it yearly.
Yes.
Which some people might say is crazy.
Some.
But again, to each their own.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't do it more than once, but I actually am oddly excited by and respect the fact that you do it every year. Mm-hmm. Even more so when we talked about what it means to you. Mm-hmm. Which is...
So, when...
Sorry, but... terrible lead-in,
you're
by the
totally
way.
Just like putting me on the spot here. Going from light conversation to super deep. Okay, so here it goes.
You can go, climbing... like, as light or as deep as you want, by the way.
Well, Fuji-san for me is kind of like that kick back into reality. Uh-huh. I mean, living out here for several years now, approaching 8 pretty soon, there were a lot of things in life that you take for granted, you know, running water, you know, a hot bath, you know, your cat meowing and purring up to you, or at least I love my cat, but, you know, this small stuff like that. But then again, there's also the minor annoyances, like, oh man, the train is late again today, or here's another earthquake, or the power went out, and you get so angry, and sometimes you obsess over these small things so much. And you don't realize just how good things can possibly be, you know?
Yeah.
So, Fuji-san for me is a way to kind of disconnect from everything, get back to the roots, and in a way kind of suffer, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because it is a grueling hike, and even though I do take 3 days, most of the time when I do take 3 days is because I go through a lightning storm in the forest, but... You know,
you're just gonna keep bringing it up, aren't you?
Dude, it sucks. But like, you go through this experience and you end up humbled, you know? That, yeah, I went through this experience, it was cold, it was miserable, but you know what? No matter through it all, I still made it to the top.
Yeah.
And regardless of there being a sunrise or not, because let's face it, 50% to 70% of the time, you don't even get to see the sunrise. It's nothing but clouds.
Yeah.
And it's just the fact that you made it, you know? You survived the raw elements of nature.
Yeah.
And if you could do that, what's an extra 5-minute wait for the train?
That's fair enough.
You know? It puts things really into perspective, and it makes you really grateful for what you have that, in your daily life, you honestly just take for granted.
Yeah. And that makes sense, too. And I think it can really bring about a certain level of calm in the day-to-day. Mm. Like, my little brother again, without getting like super heavy. I often talk on the vlog about my little brother Alexander, but I do have another little brother named Jesse. And Jesse got hit with some serious like health struggles in his life. His diet got very, very restricted. He ended up with like Crohn's and celiac and all this other stuff. And then it hit him so hard at one point that he almost lost his life. And after that, he has been so much of a changed person. He is so chill. He has so much stuff in perspective. Like, something that can come up that will just stress me out like crazy. And he's like, dude, you're alive. The people around you are healthy. Like, you'll deal with that. That's not going to kill you. It might cost you money or a bunch of time, but you're going to come through it. It's not worth spending that much of your energy on, man. There are much heavier things. And I liked that when we talked about it previously, you had said that for you, it's kind of a yearly reset.
Yes.
Because sometimes there'll be that one thing that happens that changes you forever. But if you're a normal human like the rest of us, every now and then you'll start to kind of slip back into the rhythms or that reality of what your normal day-to-day is, and you kind of need a reminder, right? So I liked the approach that this was your... excuse me, my voice is starting to go here. I liked the approach that this was like your yearly reset.
Yes.
There's a certain level of depth in there that I really appreciate, so...
And I mean, overall, I do this for me, primarily. You know, I'm not looking for fame or like, hey, there's the Sea to Summit guy, but... I mean, I enjoy it. It's my reset, and it keeps me grounded to earth.
Yeah. So, outside of that, I guess the only other thing I could say is, like, little pieces of advice, right? Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people are like, oh, can I climb on my own, or should I take a tour, right? Well, on you talked previously about if you're taking one of the popular routes, a tour might be your only option. To actually, you know, get a hut, if that's the thing you want to do. Do you, like, recommend for first-time climbers, like, tour over doing it by yourself or vice versa, or...?
To be honest, you have to know yourself. And you have to know what your limitations are and know what you're willing to kind of put yourself through. If you want to just test the waters, I just highly recommend, if you're already thinking like that, go with a group.
Okay.
Go with a group, see what it's like, and you'll be taken care of. One of the worst things to do is that if you don't know your limitations and you go by yourself, and something happens to you, you are by yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and that's far more dangerous, and if you're going to climb it, just be safe.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Yeah, see... I didn't, like, obviously if you're going with a group of friends, that's going to be a little bit different than just climbing by yourself. I don't think I would recommend going through any mountain or, like, forest experience by yourself.
Correct, yes.
Either way, I think I kind of poorly phrased that before when I was saying by yourself, air quotes. It was more like, you know, can you do it without the guide of a tour?
Correct.
Outside of that. Is there anything you would recommend? Like, do you bring any emergency gear? Like, do you bring, like a flare set or, like, matches or anything? I hear you laughing as you say it, but...
I laugh because half of the gear that I pack is emergency gear.
Okay.
I have emergency matches. I have a flint.
Yeah.
I have an emergency bag, one of the space bags. Very small and compact sleeping bag as well.
Gotcha.
I have a like a poncho tarp that's waterproof.
Nice.
Just in case. And then I always have emergency kind of like rations as well. And another thing that I like to do is Japan likes to sell these salt candies.
Okay.
During the summertime.
Yeah.
And these are invaluable.
Like the 100 yen stores too,
yeah.
Right?
They're invaluable during this trip because one, it keeps you focused on something else aside from just walking. And two, helps kind of like replenish some of the salts and stuff that you're like sweating out constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
Aside from that, it's just bringing that extra sweater because you never know if it's gonna get if you're gonna get wet because of the rain, or bringing that extra pair of socks because you know your your feet are drenched or something like that. It's just bringing something for that just in case scenario, basically.
That makes just as much sense.
Yeah. And on top of that, I bring pain meds, bandages, band-aids themselves, and kind of like Neosporin type stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah, see, all of that, like literally all of that makes... I brought so much like ibuprofen and like all that stuff, band-aids. I also brought an entire roll of duct tape.
Nice.
Which, by the way, came in handy. Because as I said, I bought a brand new pair of like Timberland style like hiking boots for the climb. And on the way down, you know how treacherous that sand slide thing can be. And I did the thing of like kind of skiing down.
Ah, yeah.
And it ripped the bottom off one of my boots. And there's no way I would have been able to climb down if it wasn't for the fact that I had this roll of duct tape and could just keep duct taping the sole back onto my boot.
Uh-huh.
And every time these sharp volcanic rocks wore through the duct tape, I would just tape it back on again.
Uh-huh.
I think I ended up doing 6-7 rounds of duct tape.
Oh, wow.
But it got me back down the hill, and I would not have had it otherwise. Plus, if you find yourself with like a tear in your clothes or something like that, right? You've got the duct tape there, so... I don't know, maybe it's American too, but I feel like carrying a roll of duct tape is a very Canadian, like, just thing to do. We had this show. Have you ever heard of the Red Green Show?
No, I've not, actually.
Okay, I feel like it's got to be Canadian. I use duct tape for everything. I brought tape on this journey, so... Awesome. I guess outside of that, do you have any like fun, exciting, crazy, unfortunate stories that you'd like to share?
Crazy or fun? I made friends with actual like some of the people up in the huts.
Okay.
So they recognize me now as the crazy foreigner. But it's an amazing experience because that when I go and stay at those huts, we pretty much just drink and share stories in the middle of the night.
Okay, I'm going to pause you right there. So you're doing a sea to summit climb.
Correct.
Which is how many kilometers?
In total, it's around 62 or so.
Okay, so that's
with
62 kilometers, you're looking at about 45 miles there or something?
About that, yeah.
Okay.
Going vertically up 3,776 meters.
That's a lot. And I'm going to say that the huts usually start from around the 7th station, right?
Usually from the 5th.
Okay, there's actually huts at the 5th station.
Yes.
Gotcha. And even the 5th station is like a good, like, 1,000 meters up there, right?
Correct, yeah.
So at that point, you're already running, like, the risk of having some altitude sickness or some effect from the altitude.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that you join the owners of these huts in consuming alcoholic beverages.
That is correct.
At these altitudes.
Yes.
That's something I kind of thought of. I was like, I might bring up, like, I think we did. I think we did, actually. I think we brought up little bottles of wine or champagne.
Uh-huh.
And drank them at the very top of the mountain, now that I think back to it. Because you can get those, like, little tiny ones at the convenience store.
Yeah.
And I think we grabbed those and just had, like, one bottle each. And just cheers at the top of the mountain to say we did it.
Uh-huh.
But our climb was done at that point.
Yeah.
What's it like to drink and then have to keep climbing?
It's fun. Well, like, the thing is, like, remember, as I said earlier, I spaced my trip out for, like, 3 days or so.
Yeah.
So my body is 100% acclimated at all times.
Fair enough.
By the time I get to the 6th station, spend the night there, head all the way up to the 9th station, or even at the top, spend the night there.
Huh.
So for me, my body's already acclimated, as opposed to somebody who does bullet climbing, which is like nonstop.
Yeah, yeah.
So from there, I'm usually fine.
Okay. Wow. I guess the only other really important point that I would want to like cover in this episode is the simple fact that the climb isn't the hardest part. Mm-hmm. Everyone's like, oh, climbing Mount Fuji is going to be the challenge. Outside of the weather, mm-hmm. which we've already talked about. And I got lucky. I had good weather.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I would say is probably the hardest part is the descent. I feel like you don't entirely agree.
I don't, but then again, I cheat and I always go the sand run route.
Okay.
So for me, the descent is easy on my knees, and I usually get down within like 45 minutes or an hour.
What? That fast?
I jet. I go down that fast.
Wow. Okay. It took me about 3 to 4 hours to get down, but mind you, that was because in the first 30 minutes, I broke my toe.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of take it slow from there. I'd say the pain has been comparable to that limp I've had all day today. But that's a story for another time. But the descent, like, your legs are dead from the climb.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, like, you kind of have no choice but to commit to it and really just, like just go down as fast as possible, right?
Yeah, it's not like you could skate down at all.
No. So that's something that I kind of, anybody who's thinking about going and climbing Mount Fuji, that I kind of wanted to put on the books. Mm. Otherwise, I would say that if you've ever considered it, in my opinion, it's one of those things that's worthwhile to do at least once.
Mm-hmm.
I think for some people, it can kind of be like a tattoo. It's that one really painful experience that they get addicted to, and then get another one, and another one, and another one. And I feel like that's kind of what's happened to you.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that.
Right? So, I think that's all that I really have to share about.
Do you have one more?
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like a mix. One is, you mentioned like, what was it again? Not velocity. The height sickness.
No, I'm losing my English
I'm
as
losing
well.
My English here.
Yeah, yeah. The Where's our English, man?
We're up too high. We just spoke about it, too.
The up too high, no
the
air sickness.
Up too high, no air sickness.
Yeah, there we go.
So, when you get higher up on the mountain, the air gets a lot more thinner. But the thing that people kind of struggle with is that they don't realize that their body is actually getting much tired.
Altitude
sickness, yes. So, your body gets really tired very fast. You'll think that you're, like, super ganky and, you know, full of energy, and you take 3 steps up, and you're just like, like, you barely breathe, I can barely even move. It's okay. Everybody else is feeling that tired, too. Once you get to the top, you should be okay. But one of the main things to be very careful of as you're climbing the mountain, watch your pace and make sure you don't sweat more than absolutely necessary.
Okay.
And the reason for this is, if you're gung-hoing it and you're just running on top and you're just sweating, your shirt is soaked, your pants are soaked, and everything, you're not going to dry off.
You're not.
You're going to be completely soaked. You're going to be up in like single-digit temperatures at the top waiting. And if you don't bring any other clothes to switch out of, you're going to be freezing the entire time.
Yeah.
So make sure you pace yourself, and it's okay to slow down to keep going forward without, you know, being a walking, like, sweat rag.
That's actually a really good point. The pacing side outside of the whole sweat thing, because I hadn't really thought of the sweat thing until you mentioned it, but you're not going to dry off,
no.
Right? And the colder it gets up there, the more layers you're going to put on, just locking in that sweat in there. But also, like, I feel like a lot of people will jump right out of the gate if they go from the 5th station and be like, yo, I'm going to sprint this first leg of the mountain. I'm going to get to the 6th or 7th station, like, right away, and just kind of overdo it there, yeah. Right? So that's another one. Pacing in general, something to watch out for. Awesome. Really, really good tips, man. You know, it's kind of funny. You and me did that, like, that video, like, I don't know, better part of a year ago.
Yeah.
And we really condensed it down. I think we did the entire thing in like a 10-minute video or
yep.
something like that. But this is a much more realistic, in-depth talk about Fuji that I've kind of always wanted to do with you, that we've done in parts.
Yes.
Like, we've done over pizza or beer or hanging out at like the fireworks festival or, you know, whatever. But we've never just sat down and done it all in one chunk.
Yeah.
I feel like we covered it all.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
So, with all of that being said, I'm going to go back to 100% focusing on the road here. I hope that this podcast hasn't been overly noisy. I do hope that you guys enjoyed this. Do keep in mind that what you hear on this episode in the background is merely the start of a brand new adventure. I can't wait to bring each and every one of you along. Hopefully Victor and I will put together, I'd say, at least one or two more podcast episodes during this adventure, because we're going to be seeing and doing some really cool stuff over the next couple of days. I just want to say thank you, Victor, for joining me on this.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, it's not like I'm going to let you out of the car here on the highway, so. And, yeah, thank you guys all for joining. I hope that no matter what you're doing, you are having a great day. I say it every single time, but if you've got a spare 30 seconds in your day, it really would mean the absolute world to me if you would jump on iTunes and leave a review for the podcast. Each one of those actually really does help the Tokyo Lens podcast. And as I say every single time, I actually really love reading them. And I'd love to see a couple more up there. So if you've got 30 seconds right now, jump on there, leave me a review, and I will read it as soon as it goes up. Thank you so much as always, and I will talk to you guys again real soon. Bye-bye.